cost of basic essentials.
The UK government has promised to have inflation in the next year, but those already on the brink say they cannot afford to wait. Saeed Pourreza, London.
EU Foreign Affairs ministers met on Monday to discuss the latest developments pertaining to the war in Ukraine. They suggest that the Wagner Group's armed mutiny in Russia last Saturday represents a risk because of the Federation's nuclear weapons. It's claimed the Kremlin has been weakened.
First, it was a threat because it was strong, it has force, and now it's becoming a risk because it may have entering in an era of political instability and internal fragility.
Putin claims Kiev and its Western masters wanted Russians to kill each other. Without mentioning Wagner's leader, Yevgeny Prigozhin, directly, Putin says the organisers of the mutiny betrayed their country. Experts have been sharing their thoughts with us.
Putin is in full control, as we have seen, and everything that was released by the mainstream media and all the politicians who are anti-Russia and supporting the war were merely expressing only their wishful thinking.
EU foreign affairs ministers have rubber-stamped an 11th package of sanctions against Russia. Many lawmakers, analysts, and even the Hungarian government say efforts to try and pressure Putin have backfired. Energy sanctions in particular have led to a cost-of-living crisis across Europe. Eurozone interest rates continue to rise. This is putting enormous strain on millions of households and businesses. Despite EU-funded investigations prior to the war revealing corruption problems at every level within Ukraine society, the 27-nation bloc continues to send billions of euro to the country. Massive amounts of deadly Western arms arrive into Ukraine every day. EU leaders are due to hold a summit this Thursday and Friday here in the Belgian capital. The war in Ukraine will dominate proceedings. If previous summits are anything to go by, do not expect a single reference to peace talks. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Muslims have arrived at Mount Arafat to perform one of the final rituals of this year's Hajj pilgrimage. It is on this day that pilgrims spend the day praying, reciting the Quran, and repenting until sunset. The day is called Arafah, and the act is known as Wuquf.
Yes, I pray for all Muslims that may Allah grant them.
The significance of this place is that it was here that the Holy Prophet of Islam delivered his last sermon. He called on Muslims to uphold human dignity, respect women's rights, uphold economic equality, avoid discrimination, and be faithful to the teachings of Islam.
Muslims should unite. Islamic unity is a necessity, but unfortunately, Muslims have different views.
Another event that takes place on Arafah is called the Disavowal of Polytheists. Pilgrims took part in this ceremony in which a message by leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, was read out.
The political aspect of the Hajj is even more important than its spiritual aspect.
The two main points of the message were unity and spirituality. He called on Muslims to use the opportunity of Hajj to get to know each other and strengthen ties in all aspects. He also pointed out that the West, specifically the U.S. and Israel, are against the unity of Muslims.
All the actions and rituals performed by the pilgrims are all intended to show Muslim unity, equality, and spiritual revelation, among other things. Lahi Tahami, Mount Arafat.
A better future for digital economy. This is what the 26th edition of the International Electronic Computer and E-commerce Exhibition, dubbed ELECOMP, promises its visitors this year. After a hiatus due to the coronavirus pandemic, state-of-the-art electronic technologies are once again on display in Tehran, offering a glimpse at what the country has to offer in this field, particularly with the activities of knowledge-based companies gaining momentum over the past couple of years.
This is a corridor presenting all the knowledge-based products of Iran.
There are more than 1,200 knowledge-based high-tech products presented in 15 different sections here. It is actually a favorable place to visit for foreign delegations traveling to Iran.
This is in line with the current administration's short and midterm plans for the digital economy to thrive. The exhibition is also laying the groundwork for a forum of ICT ministers of eco-countries to be held next month in Tehran.
Regional countries are the main customers of our products. We have managed to gain a foothold in Azerbaijan, Armenia, Iraq, and Afghanistan. That is because we offer the latest technology at a reasonable price.
Over 450 domestic and 50 foreign companies are present, offering their latest services and sharing their experiences in workshops held on the sidelines of the exhibition.
We have that digital tools available in the market that are not available here, so we think that that could be beneficial for Iranian companies to use our resources, and we think that we can use the resources Iranian companies have, like their skills in a digital marketplace, the market size and all that stuff.
I didn't know that startup scene here is so is going in good way. We've been in Paradise Technology Park. There is incubators, accelerators. I didn't have idea about that. We are also doing the same things. We can connect on these ideas together, looking for investors, VC funds and startups, and make some good unicorns.
We believe that communication by our countries will be great, will be growth, and we will be nearly than in the past.
Elecomp is the greatest commercial event in Iran's market of electronics and computer products and services. Since its first edition in 1995, it has been providing a unique opportunity for businesses active in this sector to grow.
As far as the Islamic Republic of Iran is concerned, digital economy is high on the agenda. In a forum of ICT ministers of the member states of the Economic Cooperation Organization, in Tehran, an infrastructure will be set up for the member states to make use of the capacities that are available. Kisum Shahmadi, Tehran.
As polls had largely predicted, the leader of the center-right party New Democracy, Kyriakos Mitsotakis, emerged as the big winner of the repeat elections held in Greece on Sunday after securing a landslide victory on May 21st elections, when the leader of the left-leaning party Syriza was left 20 percentage points behind. Mitsotakis swept once again the parliamentary elections, obtaining over 40% of Sunday's ballot. In the May 21st elections, under a proportional electoral law, the New Democracy leader didn't gather enough votes to win an outright majority. This time, thanks to new election rules, Mitsotakis has been rewarded with a bonus of up to 50 seats, which grants him an absolute majority in the 300-seat Greek parliament.
Με το σημερινό εκλογικό αποτέλεσμα.
For the second time in just a few weeks, the citizens have not only told us to continue on the path we set 4 years ago, but they have told us to move faster because the country needs it. Greece is opening a new historic chapter.
During his first term as Prime Minister, Mitsotakis was accused of orchestrating mass wiretaps of lawmakers and journalists and came under heavy criticism following a deadly train accident last February. Recently, he has also been attacked by opposition politicians and members of non-governmental organizations over the handling of the sinking of a trawler carrying as many as 750 migrants in the Mediterranean, in which hundreds of people are believed to have drowned.
Right or left, whoever wins, it makes no difference for the Greek people. It must be clear that Greece's present and future are in the hands of the European Commission.
Mitsotakis has so far pushed forward a large privatization program, which has included the sale of public assets and crucial infrastructures, and cut spending policies on public services, which have resulted in a further welfare retrenchment.
The biggest problem of Greece is the economical problem. The country needs new jobs, a lot of new jobs.
Also this time, the participation rate in Greece's elections only reached 60%, one of the lowest levels ever recorded in the country since it became a republic in 1974. Mitsotakis will soon be given an exploratory mandate to form a government by Greek President Katerina Sakellaropoulou. After years of financial crisis, Mitsotakis' biggest challenge will be turning Greece into a real player in the European Union without leaving too many Greeks behind. Max Civili, Athens.
The spectacular geological site of outstanding natural beauty lies within the limits of the Aras River to the north and the southern end of the Lesser Caucasus mountain range. Designated by the UNESCO, Aras Geopark enjoys a range of climates as well as rich geodiversity and biodiversity while linking different cultures on the northern and southern sides of the mountain chain.
As of today, I extend my invitation to anyone from across the world who loves our planet and who wants to learn more about the geologic history of Earth to visit this spectacular heritage where 400 million years of evolution is documented.
Definitely a cause for celebration. The recent UNESCO designation is the result of decades of hard work by Iranian experts and officials on both a local and national level.
In 1995, a group of experts, including myself, started working on the dossier to present it to UNESCO. There were many ups and downs, but eventually, with the support of all managers of Aras Free Zone organization, throughout these years, the region was finally designated as a UNESCO geopark.
Located in Iran's East Azerbaijan province, Aras Geopark covers an area of about 1,670 square kilometers. The highest point being Mount Kiamaki and Julfa, arching over 3,347 meters into the sky, and the lowest, the Aras River Valley. This is definitely a geotourism attraction with a diverse tectonic structure, flora and fauna.
At Aras Free Zone Organization, we managed to follow up this dossier and it led to this achievement. But let's not forget that this is only the beginning. There's still a lot that needs to be done.
400 million years of the history of the Earth is summed up in this region, making a perfect destination for scientists and researchers.
The UNESCO Global Geopark designation was created in 2015 and recognizes geological heritage of international significance. The recent designation of Aras Geopark brings the total up to 195 sites, covering a surface area of about 486,000 square kilometers worldwide.
The UNESCO designation of Aras Geopark is considered a turning point, not just because it can act as a magnet for tourists, but also because it raises awareness about sites and landscapes of international geological significance. Gisumish Ahmadi, Aras.
Our Archmond, Ahmed Ghulamifard and Hosseini Mofrid arrive in court in The Hague having travelled from Iran to seek justice. A fifth Iranian man, Ghadir Jafari, is also part of the campaign but couldn't attend due to ill health. The former soldiers say two Dutch firms supplied chemicals to Saddam Hussein in the 1980s and the Iraqi dictator used these to create and deploy deadly mustard gas.
In December 1986, I was exposed to a gas attack. My lungs are burned. I have problems with my respiratory system.
The men's lawyers are in no doubt that Dutch firms Malkomi and KBS Holland are culpable.
The mustard gas produced in those years and up until 86 can only have been produced with their chemicals. And so we say the victims that fell in that period, some of whom are here today, must have been, it can't be different, must have been injured by the chemicals of this Dutch company.
The regime of Western-backed Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein killed and severely injured tens of thousands of Iranians during the 1980 to 1988 war, often using chemical weapons. Experts say mustard gas kills slowly from the inside out.
It basically burns the whole lung. And it also damages the eye and skin, immune system. It can cause cancer.
Those seeking justice say their main aim is to save others from ever going through their agony.
I want my voice to be heard so that no one else in the world will use chemical weapons again like they did against us. The world needs tougher regulations to prevent development, production and use of these weapons.
The Dutch firms being sued by survivors claim the chemicals they supplied to Iraq were intended for agricultural pesticide use only. Having listened to a full day of complex evidence, the three judges presiding over this case in the district court ruled that a verdict will be delivered on the 23rd of August. Jerome Hughes, The Hague.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The Zionist regime's practices against Palestinian children include arresting them in the dead of night, arresting them without a court order and without explanation, handcuffing and blindfolding them, preventing their parents, family members or lawyers from accompanying them, and subjecting them to beatings and insults. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. The Electronic Intifada wrote in this regard, in its latest attack on Gaza, the Zionist regime killed at least 33 Palestinians within 5 days. The attack was accompanied by calls from the Zionist regime's government ministers, including the overt fascist Itamar Ben-Gvir and Bezalel Smotrich, for greater violence, in effect the intensification of genocide. Gaza has long been acquainted with the Zionist regime's policies of extermination. Yet, not a single action has been taken against the Zionist regime by any country nor by any Western democracy. The failure of the United Nations to hold the Zionist regime accountable for its crimes indicates complicity. That is precisely why Palestinian civil society issued its 2005 call for boycott, divestment, and sanctions. Such appeals are not addressed to the sanctimonious international community, but rather to solidarity groups and other civil society organizations around the world. Palestinians have advocated effective campaigning with the aim of compelling the fabricated regime of Israel to end its aggression against Gaza and the West Bank. The apartheid regime of Israel would not be able to commit all its war crimes against Palestinians in general, and Gazans in particular, without the full impunity offered by the international community. That is a glaring fact. It is unnecessary to remind the civilized world that the fabricated regime of Israel has mounted a continuous wave of attacks against the civilian population in Gaza. In September 2007, Gaza was declared an enemy entity. The Zionist regime prevented a wide range of food and basic materials from being imported into Gaza. It was even revealed that the Zionist regime's bureaucrats decided how many calories people in Gaza could consume. Fuel and electricity were cut too. Gaza has endured an electricity crisis for many years. The Zionist regime has turned Gaza into the largest concentration camp in the world. Its people have to dig tunnels so that they can bring fuel, medicine, and other necessities from Egypt into Gaza. True. We do hear words of sympathy from international community. One wonders what it will take to translate those words into action. Children killed in the early hours of the morning? Among the 7 children killed in Gaza recently were 4-year-old Hajar al-Bahtini and Ali, and Mayar Ezzedine, aged 8 and 12. U.S.-sourced warplanes were used to bomb their homes. Other children were orphaned. The dentist and hospital administrator Jamal Khaswan and his wife Mervat were killed, along with one of their sons. They leave behind 4 other children. To the Zionist regime, the children it killed were just collateral damage of its military onslaught, grotesquely named Operation Shield and Arrow. To justify the dehumanization of Palestinian children, Maurice Hirsch, who spent almost 2 decades in the Zionist regime's Military Advocate General Corps, tweeted that while the incidental loss of life of non-combatants is always unfortunate, the laws of war take into account that this is a possible and even legitimate result. And in much worse tweet, he goes further, considering the military advantage gained by eliminating these senior terrorists, it is irrelevant to ask how many children were incidentally killed. Hirsch's words encapsulate the Zionist ideology. Under the Zionist regime's genocidal, settler, colonial doctrine, the lives of the natives are irrelevant. Natives have to be eliminated so that white European colonizers, in this case Jewish supremacists, can flourish. According to the UN Universal Declaration of Human Rights, everyone has the right to a standard of living adequate for the health and well-being of himself and of his family, including food, clothing, housing, and medical care, and necessary social services, and the right to security in the event of unemployment, sickness, disability, widowhood, old age, or other lack of livelihood in circumstances beyond his control. Apparently, that right does not apply to the Palestinians. Such is the cruel logic of settler colonialism of the fabricated regime of Israel. Meanwhile, Arab News reported the Zionist regime security forces arrest about 1,000 Palestinian children from the streets, schools, and homes of the West Bank each year, and about the same number from East Al-Quds on suspicion of involvement in attacks or protest. Children's rights organizations say such practices are abusive and harm youngsters' physical and mental health. They are prohibited by international laws and agreements related to the children's rights, to which the Zionist regime is a signatory. According to the organizations, the Zionist regime's practices against Palestinian children include arresting them in the dead of night, arresting them without a court order and without explanation, handcuffing and blindfolding them, preventing their parents, family members, or lawyers from accompanying them, and subjecting them to beatings and insults. The bodies say that children are exposed to physical pain and psychological pressure and go through experiences of loneliness, intense fear, confusion, humiliation, helplessness, and sometimes a sense of danger of death. They add that many children report severe post-traumatic symptoms following their release. Jessica Montel, executive director at Israel-based human rights organization Ha Moked, told Arab News, "Israel ignores its legal obligation to consider the child's best interest when it comes to Palestinian children wanted for interrogation. Traumatic night arrest remain the default method for bringing in Palestinian children." Ha Moked has petitioned the Israeli High Court against this practice. "We are demanding the Israeli military send a summons to parents when children are wanted for questioning." Adura Fares, director of the Palestinian Prisoners Club, told Arab News that the Zionist regime's military authorities 5 years ago introduced amendments to the law of military occupation in the West Bank and the civilian law in East Al-Quds to allow the arrest and trial of children aged 12 and upwards. Fares added that a series of alternative punishments have been adopted in East Al-Quds, such as fines, release on bail or house arrest, a 1 or 2 month in which the child's family deposits $6,000 with the court, and the amount is confiscated if the child leaves his home during the period of house arrest. Fares said house arrest for children is more difficult than ordinary imprisonment, as this method makes parents jailers for their children so they do not lose the money. Many children who are detained at home hate their parents, who have to ensure they remain imprisoned in the house until the end of the sentence, he said. A total of 160 Palestinian children are currently serving sentences in the Zionist regime prisons after being arrested for joining protests, raising the Palestinian flag or throwing stones. An Israeli settler shot dead a Palestinian recently. Ala Ghaysiyeh, 28, was killed in the settlement of Tana Umrim in Az-Zihriya, southwest of Al-Khalil. The shooting brought the number of Palestinians killed by the Zionist regime occupation forces and settlers since the beginning of the year to 157, including 36 in Gaza during May. The total includes 26 children. 4 Palestinians were wounded by live bullets during clashes with the Zionist regime military forces, while settlers burnt 5 vehicles and 270 bales of straw between the villages of Tor Musaya and Al-Mughaber, east of Ramallah. The Zionist regime army has begun arresting members of the Popular Front for Liberation of Palestine. The Zionist regime intelligence officers are texting PFLP members, warning them not to participate in activities of the organization. A former prisoner and member of the PFLP confirmed to Arab News that he had received a message adding that warnings had recently increased from the Zionist regime's intelligence agency, Shin Bet. It has been reported that more than 100 Palestinians affiliated with PFLP have been arrested in recent weeks.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Thank you.
Iraq's attack on Iran in the 1980s killed many Iranians with the help of Western-supplied military equipment. The Sardasht chemical attack, which occurred 36 years ago, in which the Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein was responsible for the killing of some 130 Iranians, may be a piece of history, but the survivors who are suffering until this day deserve justice and have not forgotten this brutal attack. The guilty ones, namely the U.S., France, the U.K., and Netherlands, as concluded by the ICJ, have not been held accountable either. In this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at why countries who preach human rights are guilty of committing the most heinous crimes, like the ones involving the use of chemical weapons. First, let me introduce our guests for this edition of the program. Christopher Halali, researcher and political analyst, joins us from Verschar, Vermont. Also joining us, Tony Gosling, historian, investigative journalist, who joins us from Bristol. Welcome to you both. Let me start with you, Tony Gosling, first, if I may. Tony Gosling, tell us, I'm going to use your researcher skills and put it to the test and ask you about what you remember of this incident that happened 36 years ago in Sardasht, or if not, then what you would stands out in your mind when it comes to the use of chemical weapons during the 8-year imposed war on Iran.
Well, look, chemical weapons, I'm afraid, are completely normal when it comes. Just look at the Vietnam War and the use of the defoliants, the destruction of the ability of the Vietnamese to grow food. That was all just sprayed. Poison was sprayed across forests, across crops, whenever the Americans felt like it. So I don't think it's actually at all fair to even put a principle that the United States may not use chemical weapons. They do it all the time, and they've been doing it right from the start. Because when they decided that they wanted, after the Suez, to take over from the British as one of the main world empires after World War II, they did it in a very, very different fashion. The British Trojan horse was to do with God and Christianity, and they would come with missionaries to persuade people. The Americans really didn't have anything other than the gun, the bomb, and poison in order to intimidate people to come into their empire. So it was a very different character. I think some would say just as bad in many ways, but the Iran-Contra scandal, I think, is the most important thing that to tease out of this relationship with Nicaragua. And I mean, for me at the time watching this, it was amazing to see it emerge in the 1980s and 90s as this incredible. Basically, what had happened was the Americans wanted to destroy Nicaragua and other countries around the world, bring them into their empire, but the politicians wouldn't let them. Congress and the House of Representatives wouldn't vote through the money that they needed to destroy these countries and to attack them. And so what they decided to do is set up an enormous multi-billion-dollar slush fund led by the military and by the intelligence services, CIA, and other criminal elements, including the mafia and the gangsters. And this organization then went around selling drugs and buying weapons and putting in people like the Contras, which are these far-right paramilitaries, mercenaries, in order to destabilize governments. And none of this was officially part of U.S. policy, but it was all going on. They were trying to pretend that it wasn't happening, pretend, keep it secret, a little bit like, you know, the Israelis do with their nuclear weapons. Let's pretend the world doesn't know we're doing this. Well, anyway, even if the Western public didn't know it was happening, certainly many people in the victim countries knew it was going on, and certainly their intelligence services and their governments knew. So that, for me, is the big takeaway with the Daniel Ortega and Nicaragua, was the link to this, the setting up of these enormous organizations, criminal, mercenary, killer organizations that would provide the money that was necessary for what the American government was not prepared to vote through. Of course, that very few, if any, of these people were ever convicted of the crimes that they committed, the international crimes they committed. In fact, I think it was George Bush Sr. gave them all pardons when he was president. So, sure. You can see there's this kind of unofficial foreign policy that was being forced on countries like this. And, of course, it completely breaks international law.
All right. Let me bring in Christopher Halali into the conversation. Christopher Halali, welcome. We're looking at 36 years since that horrible incident that happened in Sardasht. I'd like to find out from you, obviously, your initial thoughts, but more so, if you can give us a depth as to the how violent and cruel a decision was made by the U.S. in terms, and other countries, I should mention, like the U.K. and France, to have provided these types of weapons, chemical weapons, to Iraq with the intent. I mean, they didn't pull the trigger, but they provided the ammunition for it, so to speak. So give us your thoughts on this, if you can.
Of course. I mean, there's no doubt in my mind that the United States, the United Kingdom, and many other partners at that time of Iraq, of Saddam Hussein's government, are liable and have blood on their hands. They are war criminals for the weapons that they gave to the Iraqi army to use against civilians and in combat against Iran in an unprovoked and violent war of aggression. And so one thing to understand is that, you know, if we look at the history, it's very humorous to me that, you know, all those years later, when America said that, you know, we have to go to war, Iraq has weapons of mass destruction, all they had to do was open up the Pentagon and look for the receipts, and they would see that they were the ones that had provided these chemical weapons, which are in international law, weapons of mass destruction. The lives, the amount of people who were not only killed and murdered by these weapons, but also maimed and wounded. And so I think that, you know, there's certainly a lot here in terms of history. And the Iranian people have not forgotten that, and nor should they, because they recognize who supported Saddam Hussein in his aggression against the Islamic Republic and against Ayatollah Khomeini's revolution and the revolution of the masses for justice. So I think, you know, if we're looking at it in the broad scale of time, you know, how many people have suffered and what a just outcome is, it's to see a lot of those war criminals up on trial for what they have done. And not only here, but, you know, as I heard coming into the program, for what they did in Latin America, connecting the struggles, because a lot of the financing, a lot of the weaponry was done at a period of time when a lot of oppressed peoples were fighting for their liberation against imperialism, and the U.S. was supporting any group that they could, legally and illegally and covertly, to have their aims.
All right. Let me ask you another thing here, Christopher Halali, if I may, that shows the depth of knowledge that the U.S. had, because the U.S. has said in its own defense that it did not know that Saddam Hussein was going to use these chemical weapons, even though the U.S. had provided it with these chemical weapons, that it didn't know that it was going to launch some kind of chemical attack. But you have the CIA files proving that the U.S. was responsible. And not only that, you have, and this is just based on a search that anyone can really get, where a retired Air Force colonel, who was a military attaché in Baghdad during the 1980s, who has said that the Iraqis, quote, never told us that they intended to use nerve gas. They didn't have to. We already knew that they would. So that's proof in itself that the U.S. was aware that Iraq was, and it's, I guess Saddam Hussein, were going to go through with this.
Oh, absolutely. Without a doubt. And don't forget, the U.S. government knew that Saddam Hussein was a thug and that Saddam Hussein was a gangster of a type. And so they wanted him to play that role. And Saddam Hussein played off the United States and the Soviet Union against each other through him. And so he would do dealings and do what he could to get concessions out of both. And of course, with the U.S. side, they were fully aware of what he was doing domestically, and they were aware of his expansionist plans. But that aligned with what the United States wanted, which was to see Ayatollah Khomeini brought down, the Islamic Republic brought down. Don't forget, they had just suffered. You remember the speech of Jimmy Carter, you know, Iran is this island of stability, you know, in a more troubled area. Well, that trouble was the Iranian people rising up against a U.S.-backed Shah. And so once that happened, and once the people, you know, wanted Khomeini, wanted the Islamic Revolution, what ended up happening? The U.S. felt that it had a huge loss, similar to that in Vietnam. They had lost this fifth largest army they had put all this money into Iran, which was now in the hands of the revolution and the weaponry and the technology. And so they felt that they wanted payback. And the payback was giving Saddam anything Saddam wanted and his government wanted to ensure that they could do that. They knew fully well. Brzezinski, all of the military brass, all of the top diplomats, they knew, and they write it in their own writings. And what they wanted was for both sides to kill each other, but more so for Iranians to spill their blood, because they had to pay for making America look weak and look bad. And they knew. They knew. The lieutenant colonel, the Air Force commander you were speaking about, it's well known. They didn't have weapons to a gangster with the idea that he's just going to keep it and just say, oh, I have it in case. No, of course he's going to use it. And they knew full well that he was going to use it. They knew full well he was going to use it throughout the conflict. And he did. And so that shows, and the CIA documents prove it, State Department, cables and everything. It all proves that the United States is culpable and morally responsible and should be held in international law because of that, of those chemical weapons, and because it knew that there was a deliberate intent to use those weapons against Iranian people, including civilians.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Tony Gosling, taking a look at that time and taking that piece of history and basically trying to make sure that this is not shelved, we're taking a look not just at that incident that happened 36 years ago, but overall taking a look at that period where the Iraqi imposed war on Iran was executed. There were more than 30 chemical attacks against Iranian non-military targets from what I'm reading here. And it's not just the U.S. that was involved. The U.K., also France, and also the Netherlands, where they provided these chemical weapons. What type of thinking was there in those countries to go ahead with this type of mentality and approach? Now, one of the things that I'm going to say, based on the research done, was that it was because, in terms of Iran's military edge, it was gaining ground against Iraq, and the U.S. figured this would be a way, though they didn't say that outright, obviously. The CIA files revealed that. But what's your take on that type of approach, using chemical weapons in a theater of war?
Well, that's right. This sort of warfare is, it's a very dangerous thing to be doing. But you know what? It's extremely convenient for the West. And I'll tell you a little anecdote, because I was working in Bristol in the CREATE Center, which is a big open plan office, back in the 1990s. And just at the coffee machine, I was just talking about what was going on in the Middle East. And the guy who was running a business just opposite me said, well, you know, we supplied, and he was talking about his business, supplied the precursor chemicals to Iraq to make the chemical weapons with. So that's how, I mean, it wasn't, and people who were, I think, involved in Britain were, Not they weren't actually complicit in the crimes, but they felt bad about what they realized afterwards these chemicals could have been used for. So they were being told that this was for innocuous purpose of some sort. And yet someone somewhere within the British military, or even outside the military, it could be just simply a private military operation of some sort, Almost certainly, though, of course, with the sanction of the Crown and maybe the Joint Chiefs, for example, in the States, or the Joint Forces in Britain, were supplying these. So, I mean, this is just literally from being in Bristol in the 1990s. I picked up this information from, and you know, he was saying, well, you know, it was us. You know, we were involved in all this, and of course, the reason is one of the purposes here is that the British and the Americans get to test these weapons without actually getting their hands dirty. So they're giving them to somebody else. They're manipulating Saddam, in this case, into thinking that he's going to make he's going to be able to keep it all secret. He's going to be able to make some kind of war-winning opportunity using these chemical weapons, but that no one will find out that they ever came from Britain. Well, this is the trouble, of course, with much of this Western policy, is that they're doing it on the assumption of secrecy. Now, look, we're living in the internet age. We were in the 1990s too. And what happens is people either, maybe this is one of the reasons they want to bring in artificial intelligence into targeting, as they're doing in Ukraine, is because the artificial intelligence may well tell no tales. What happens is when human individuals are involved in these atrocities and breaking international law, they have a guilty conscience. Many of them, anyway, or most of them, have a conscience, and they think to themselves, well, afterwards, that wasn't the right thing to do. And if some investigator comes along and asks them, even if it's just many years after, were you involved in this, they may be very happy to talk about it, to get it off their conscience. And so I can tell you almost certainly that some of the precursors for those chemical weapons probably came from Bristol in England, and if there was an investigation, you may even find where exactly they were made. But that's why they do it. They want to test these weapons out, and they also want to dirty the hands of people who, you know, like it's like the shaking hand of Tony Blair. When he comes and shakes your hand, that means that you're for the scaffold. That means you're about to be executed, and you're going to be let go. And they've been manipulating smaller countries like that for many years, trying to bring them into their confidence and then destroying them.
All right. Piece of fact coming out of that imposed war on Iran, I'd like to break it up a little bit more with you, Christopher Hilali. It was reported that the United States learned through satellite imagery at the time that Iran was about to gain a major strategic advantage on the ground over the Iraqi forces. And at that time, U.S. Intelligence officials, they actually conveyed the locations of the Iranian troops to Iraq, fully aware that Saddam Hussein's military was going to use these chemical weapons, which included sarin, based on the report that we have, which is a lethal nerve agent. I'd like to find out from you, when you have that type of approach by the U.S., how that is actually then repeated when it comes to the Iraq War 1 and 2, when it comes to other theaters of war that the U.S. has been involved in, and also most recently where the U.S. Was contemplating giving approval for depleted uranium to Ukraine to be used in the, from the tanks that they have. Why is it that the U.S. feels like it has to subscribe to chemical weapons or even depleted uranium, which they used in the Iraq War also, in order to achieve their so-called goals?
Absolutely, it must be stated, without a doubt, that the United States not only provides intelligence, as you mentioned, satellite imagery, troop movements, and locations for where, there are buildups of forces from the quote-unquote enemy that they provide to their local forces on the ground, be it, in this case, to Saddam's army, or whether it be in Yugoslavia or even contemporary, giving locations of Russian positions to Ukrainians to use the HIMARS and other artillery that they have and their drones and airstrikes to target Russian forces. So this is known throughout, recent history that the United States does this. It's part of their warfighting strategy, is to give this important intelligence to the armies carrying out their wills. And that's what really makes these wars proxy wars, but even more so now, because of the armaments and things like that, much more dangerous and higher level than even proxy wars. In going back to Iraq and the Iraqi imposed war on Iran, Iranians had the advantage at one point in the war, and actually quite a few points in the war, but especially because this was an unprovoked war on the Iranian people, on the Iranian nation. And so the willpower to fight back. And of course, the United States tried to create, stoke sectarianism, ethnic tensions, religious tensions, you know, down in Bandar Abbas, you know, where you have a lot of Arabs who many of them are Sunni. Of course, you have in the reports, we're going to, you know, so they're going to be natural allies of the Ba'athist army because Saddam is, you know, Arab, he's Sunni. And so, but that didn't happen. In fact, the opposite happened. They were loyal and patriotic, and they believed that this was an attack on the entire Iranian nation. So they fought even harder to preserve the nation. And so, of course, with this advantage, the United States gave a lot of the locations, a lot of the troop movements to the Iraqi military with state-of-the-art technology in order for Iraq not only to target those forces, but as the previous colleague here mentioned, to use and to test these chemical weapons and to see their accuracy, to see their potency and their lethality. And so they had all that data. That data came off the ground and went into the reports, many of them top secret, many of them will never see. But they're there, and they knew that this was going to happen, and they wanted it to happen. We know that this war imposed on Iran was meant to dislodge the Islamic Revolution because it was such a profound threat to the United States and to its regional partners. And so, of course, with this in mind, there's full knowledge of what was going to transpire.
Okay.
And it should be stated again that the United States has done this and continues to do it and will do it into the future, providing locations, providing geospatial imagery, satellite imagery, everything like that to ensure that its forces or its proxies have the advantage in fighting. And of course, in using these kinds of weapons. The depleted uranium was used throughout the previous decades. And that, of course, has caused long-term damage and health defects and environmental damage. And they knew that.
And the images that we've been showing in this program are testament to not only the brutality and the side effects that these unfortunate victims suffered during that time, but how this has been now passed on generation after generation. Yet the U.S. still keeps the sanctions, Tony Gosling, in place to this day, where there are people who are still suffering here inside of Iran. Why doesn't the U.S. get some relief in that way for Iranians who are suffering from this brutal event that took place, of which you know, so many people actually not only died from it, but to this day are suffering from it?
Well, I think it's because it's suffering from a brutal meltdown in internal democracy. And what you ended up with is a criminal clique that the last thing they want to do is to admit their many, many sins and faults. That's why they won't get rid of these sanctions. And unless there is a complete shift in government in the United States, which looks unlikely at the moment, you're going to, I'm afraid, have these criminals protecting themselves
Sure.
rather than...